Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the Teaching Company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled The History of Ancient Egypt, Part 2. The lecturer is Professor Bob Breyer. Professor Breyer is an Egyptologist and professor of philosophy at the C.W. Post campus of Long Island University. A native New Yorker, Professor Breyer was born in the Bronx, where he still lives today. He received his Ph.D. in philosophy from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 1970. He began teaching at C.W. Post campus in 1972. From 1981 to 1996, he served as chairman of the philosophy department. He has also served as the director of the National Endowment for the Humanities Egyptology Today program. Professor Breyer has twice been selected as a Fulbright Scholar and is a recipient of the David Newton Award for Teaching Excellence. In 1994, Professor Breyer became the first person in 2,000 years to mummify a human cadaver in the ancient Egyptian style. This research was the subject of a National Geographic television special, Mr. Mummy. Dr. Breyer is also the host of the Learning Channel series titled The Great Egyptians. In addition to his television and teaching experience, Professor Breyer is the author of several books and scholarly articles. His most recent books include The Murder of Tutankhamun, Egyptian Mummies, Encyclopedia of Mummies, and Daily Life in Ancient Egypt. Each of Professor Breyer's lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, a bibliography, and the ancient Egyptian alphabet in hieroglyphs. You might find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Lecture 13, The Middle Kingdom, Dynasty 12.
Hello again. What I'd like to start with is a little bit of a review, because we've been covering a lot of history. Remember two lectures ago, we had the complete collapse of Egypt. There was anarchy, there was no real pharaoh, we hardly have any records. Well, the next dynasty, right, the 11th dynasty that we talked about last time, they got it all together again. It wasn't easy. They had first those Intefs who were kind of just claiming they were kings, but they weren't really kings. And then finally, the Mentuhoteps pulled it together. Well, in this lecture, I want to show you that Egypt continues on a roll. They really do. We're going to have Dynasty 12 here. And what we've got are kings who are sort of have an establishment mentality. You're going to see these are guys who don't have to prove anything. They've pulled the country together. You're going to see that they control all of Egypt. They build pyramids. They foster great religion, religious texts. And also, you're going to see that they're very skilled at controlling the press. Now, there weren't newspapers then, but they control literature in an interesting way for political purposes. So that's what I'm going to try to do. But let me start with a little bit of art history. Now, remember in the first lecture, I talked about how there are different approaches to history of Egypt. There were the philologists, you know, who look at language and try to figure things out. And then there were the art historians who look at statues and paintings and try to figure something out about the history. Well, this is a good point to talk about that. Remember the Mentuhoteps. They are the first kings who really pull it together. Mentuhotep I is the one who really unites Egypt. Well, there are statues of Mentuhotep. And what they show is a kind of football player type guy. It's brute force. He has a thick neck. His hands look like hams, right? And what he's really saying, in a sense, is, I'm powerful, right? That's one thing that the art tells us. But another thing that it tells us is that they didn't know how to do it well yet. Now remember, the previous period was total anarchy. You didn't have royal studios of sculptors anymore. They weren't supporting artists like they used to. So by the time Mantuhotep becomes king, he's got the wherewithal to do whatever he wants. Remember, he builds a big temple? But his statue, it's a clunker. They didn't have the sculptors. They hadn't learned how to do it yet. Well, if you look at the art of the next dynasty, the one I'm going to talk about today, Dynasty 12, it's refined. By now, they've developed royal studios. They've got artists who've been working for a while. And these guys are getting really skilled. So, very often, the art historical approach will tell us something that anything else won't. Now, let's start with this dynasty. The first king, his name is Amenemhat I. Right? And his name is important. He's a commoner. He is not royalty. Dynasty 11 ended, and we have a new dynasty, and I think that he was the vizier, the equivalent of the prime minister of the previous pharaoh. Right? So he's probably an important guy, but he has no royal blood in his veins. But he does something very interesting. Right? He has a papyrus written, right? And it's supposed to be fiction, right? Sort of. It takes place way back in the good old days. The papyrus is in Leningrad in Russia. And what he says is he sort of tells the people that he was prophesied to be king. He was going to be king. Let me tell you what it says. It's really neat. It's an example of how you can sort of create your own literature. And it's like a newspaper that he's printing for himself. Here's what the papyrus says. He says, now remember, there was an intermediate period. Life was terrible before. The prophet is saying, in the future there's going to be terrible times. But then something's going to happen. He says, then a king will come from the south. Ameni will be his name. Now, Ameni is like the nickname for Amenemhat, right? So we know he's talking about something. This is who's going to come. Ameni's going to come. He says, he will take the white crown. He will take the red crown, right? Now, he's going to wear both crowns. He's going to unify Egypt. So Amenemhat is writing this papyrus, or having it written for him, to tell people, I'm a legitimate pharaoh. It was prophesied, right? And he says, he will join the two mighty lands, right? He says, he will rejoice, O people of his time. The Son of Man will make his name for all eternity. Now, when he says the Son of Man, what he's really doing is he's acknowledging that he's a commoner. Remember, the pharaohs were called Sa-Re, son of Re, son of the sun. Right? So he's saying, look, there's this papyrus that predicts that somebody's going to come, become king of Egypt with a red crown and the white crown, and Ameni's going to be his name. And people are going to rejoice in his time. So he's, in a sense, created his own legend. But he's saying, I'm a legitimate king, right? Because I'm prophesied. Now, as you know, kings had more than one name. He's got another name, his Horus name. And that name, he calls himself Repetition of Births. Now, Repetition of Births, what does that mean? Well, if you think about it, it's almost literally Renaissance, a rebirth. What Ameni is saying is that under me, there's going to be a rebirth of Egypt's greatness. They're going to make Egypt great again. So his name is important. Now, he founds a new capital. Remember, he comes from the south, probably around Thebes, which is in the south, right, in Upper Egypt. But he moves the capital. The capital is moved to an area in the Fayum. Now, the Fayum is in the north. Right? It's about 30 miles out of Cairo, southwest of Cairo. It's in the north. And it's a kind of lush area. Rather green. There's a depression where there's a lake. It's kind of pleasant. And he calls the new capital city Itali, binder of the two lands. So in other words, he's going back in this old theme of, hey, we're unifying Egypt again. We're going to be together. Now, he has money. This is now not the 11th dynasty when they're just fighting their way to get back to greatness. He's got money, and he does big things. One way you can tell if a dynasty is doing well, is look at the tombs. Are they big? Are they lavish? And if you look at the tombs of his officials, people who ruled during his era, you can see they're big. Now, for example, there are tombs at a place called Beni Hassan. Beni Hassan is just Arabic, right? It means the sons of Hassan. It's a place in the middle of Egypt. And we call it actually Middle Egypt, right? Between upper and lower, you know, you don't know what to call it. It's Middle Egypt. And this is where there are big tombs of guys called the nomarchs. Now, Egypt was divided into 42 nomes. but they're equivalent of our states, just like states in the United States, Texas, New York, right? Nomes. And the rulers of each state, who would be our governors, were called nomarchs, right? Rulers of nomes. Their job was basically collect the taxes for each nome, each guy collected the taxes, and send the pharaoh his share in the capital, which was now in the Fayum. We have the tombs of the nomarchs of this dynasty at Beni Hassan, right, Middle Egypt, and they're spectacular. They're large, cut into rock-cut caves, right? They're like caves cut into rock-cut of a mountain, beautifully painted, rather unusual, by the way. It shows scenes of daily life, which is normal. It shows people wrestling. It shows the army working out, doing maneuvers, kind of, you know. And it almost is like, remember when you were a kid, there were these little booklets you could flip and the people would move, the little cartoon figures would move when you flipped them? It's like that. You have a long sequence of figures, guys wrestling, first one hold, then another hold, then another hold, and it kind of gives you a sense of motion. It's rather nice. And in the tomb of one of these nomarchs, Chanum Hotep is his name. Now, Chanum Hotep. Chanum was a ram-headed god, right? This was an important god, and his name means Chanum is pleased, right? And this was the antelope gnome, right? So there's the right area. Chanum Hotep says on his walls that during his reign, they did an entirely new survey of the land. Now, a survey is important. Remember that the Nile overflows each year, covering the land on both sides. What that means is you're erasing boundary markers. You know, like a farmer may have had a stone here, a stone there, where his land ends, another guy begins. Well, once you get the inundation, you've got to resurvey, right? And when Chanum Hotep can say, we resurveyed the land, it shows that there's stability again. It shows that they're back to the good old days of people have land, everybody knows where his place is. That's important. You know, the inundation also really got the Egyptians into mathematics, because they had to do some geometry to do resurveying. It's kind of a practical thing, though. They never did mathematics for the abstract sense of just doing math. It was always a practical application. But this survey was important. And during the reign of Amenemhat I, they did the survey. So it's an establishment mentality. These guys are saying, we've arrived, nothing much to prove. And Amenemhat I builds himself a pyramid. Again, they're hearkening back to the good old days of the old kingdom. Remember Sneferu, the pyramid builder? Almost every time I see something that looks good that the Egyptians are trying to do, I think of Sneferu. I think they're looking back to him and saying, he's our model. We're back to those good old days. So he builds a pyramid. It's a modest affair, but it's a pyramid. But what's important, the entrance is on the north side. Now, why is the entrance on the north side? Usually the entrance to pyramids are about maybe a third of the way up, roughly, a little less perhaps. And then you get a passageway going down, and then there's inner passageways. But the pyramid entrance is almost always, up until this point, it's almost always at the same place. Why? Because it points to the North Star. Now, the North Star is a star that doesn't seem to move, right? Other stars are circumpolar going around it, but it sort of seems fixed. And the idea was that the pharaoh is associating himself with a fixed, eternal North Star. The pharaoh is going to be forever, immutable, right? Now, Amenemhat I pyramid has the entrance at the right place, right? North place. That shows its tradition again. We're established, right? So he has this modest pyramid, but on the north, where it should be. You'll see this a little important later. Now, Amenemhat institutes something that's never been done before in Egypt, I believe. What we call co-regency. In the last 10 years of his reign, he says, I'm going to take my son, whose name is Sesostris, we'll get to that. I'm going to take my kid, and I'm going to make him king with me. He's going to be co-regent. We are going to have two kings at the same time. Now, why do that? You know, it's a new thing. Why do it? I think the answer is that Amenemhat is thinking back to the intermediate period, unstable times, and he wants to make sure that his son is going to rule if something happens to him. So he says, all right, my kid is ruling with me. So if anything happens to Amenemhat, the successor is established. Now remember, Amenemhat was a commoner, right? He was just named Ameni, the son of a man, a commoner. but he wants to make sure that his son will succeed him as pharaoh. So we have a co-regency. This is something that this dynasty is going to keep up. And you'll see, future dynasties will use it very efficiently. So he's a co-regent. Now, it looks like it's a good thing that he did it. There is evidence that Amenemhat I was murdered. Right? Now, when I say evidence, you know, we're not 100% sure, but there's a papyrus. It's a wonderful tale, by the way. It's a fiction. It reads like a fiction, and I'm pretty sure it is basically fiction. It's called The Tale of Sinuwe. And there's a terrific, I think it's a 1950s movie based on it called The Egyptian. It's a great film. But anyway, it says the following. Sinuwe is a palace official, and he's out of the country with the pharaoh's son, the co-regent. And word reaches them that the pharaoh, Amenemhat I, has been killed. Now the son rushes back to Egypt. But Sinuwe is afraid. He's afraid of anarchy. He's afraid that there'll be chaos in Egypt. He doesn't know what's going to happen. Again, he knows what happened during the intermediate period. He doesn't want that again. So he doesn't go back. And for much of his life, he stays outside the borders of Egypt, afraid to return to his homeland. Now, there's a kind of happy ending. Eventually, the new king, Sesostris, you know, says, why is Arsinoe staying away? Why doesn't he come home? There's no bad feelings. There's nothing. Why doesn't he come home? And they send a messenger. Now, he's an old man by now, Sinuwe. But they bring him back. And he returns to the palace and he's taken care of. So it has a happy ending. But the papyrus suggests that Amenemhat was murdered. Now, I think he was. I'll tell you why. And remember I said that this is a dynasty that learns how to manipulate the press. They use literature for their own purposes. Well, there's another document, which is supposedly the advice of Amenemhat I, written by Amenemhat I, for his son. Sort of wisdom literature. This is how you run a country, kid. Right? Now, I think it was written by the son, not by the father. I think Sesostris really wrote it after the father was dead. And you'll see why. Let me read you a little section, and I'll tell you something about this one. It's pretty cynical. I mean, you know, remember, the son's father has been killed. And it's giving advice about how to lead a country. And what he says is the following. Now, this is supposedly Amenemhat talking to his son. He says, beware of the subjects who are nobodies, right? Beware of those who are plotting that you're not aware of. Don't trust your brother. Don't have any friends, right? That's pretty cynical. He says, I gave to the beggars. I helped the poor. And look what happened to me. He says, I gave myrrh to people. Now, myrrh was a really precious spice, he says, and they didn't help me. Myrrh, by the way, a little sidebar, myrrh was what was used by the ancient Egyptians as chewing gum, also as breath mints. They would take myrrh and mix it with wax, and you could kind of chew it, and that was your chewing gum. But anyway, that's a sidebar. Back to Amenemhat's advice. He says, but he who ate my food raised opposition, right? He whom I trusted plotted against me. And then he almost describes how he was killed. Right now, obviously, this is not quite Amenemhat doing it, but he says, it was after supper, during the night, weapons for my protection were turned against me. So it was an internal plot. Possibly his very own guards did this to him. And he says, you know, I had assigned order to everything. Life was good. And look what happened. Right? So, I think he really was killed. It's a rare thing. Now, there's a kind of funny political problem here. The king is divine, a god. You can't really come out and say, my father was murdered. It's kind of the thing you just don't talk about. It's kind of like when the Queen of England gets indigestion. You don't talk about it. And so he couldn't come out and say in this document that my father was murdered. So they talk about the plot, they talk about weapons being turned, but they never say he was actually killed. And at the end it says, he's talking to his son supposedly, I give you the contents of my heart. It says, wear the white crown of a god's son. The seal is in its place, assigned by me. The seal is in its place, assigned by me. What he means is, you're the legitimate heir. I made you co-regent. You're in, kid. So, but it's a cynical document, really cynical. But Amenemhat I, I think, was really murdered. But anyway, his son takes over, Sesostris I, right? Who's also called Senwasrit. There are many ways of transliterating the name. Same guy, Senwasrit, Sesostris. Sesostris is the Greek ending. He's another great king. I mean, he was a chip off the old block. He was like his father. Maybe the 10 years of co-regency really helped hone his skills. You know, he was king with his father for a while. That, by the way, must have been an interesting situation in Egypt. Two kings at the same time. Because remember, the pharaoh was really the god Horus on earth. Did you have two Horuses on earth? I don't know what they thought about that. But Sesostris builds forts in Nubia. Now, let me say something about Nubia. Remember that Nubia is the equivalent of the Sudan. Right? They didn't have firm borders. Egypt's border ended in the south at a place that is today called Aswan. It's a natural border. There are big boulders in the water, in the Nile, a cataract it's called. And that's where Egyptian soil sort of ended, and Nubia began. Now remember, Nubia is not what the ancient Egyptians called it. That's a later word. They called it Kush. That's biblical Kush, right? The Kush of the Bible. So, he builds forts in Nubia because he wants to control the gold and the trade. Now, he builds forts fairly far south at a place that today is called Wadi Halfa. There's another big cataract in that area. And about 50 miles south, he builds two forts, one on either side of the Nile. Now, these forts are impressive, let me tell you. They are big. The walls are 30 feet high. They're about 15 feet thick. They're made of mud brick. But, you know, if you were trying to get into that fort, it would not be easy. What Sesostris did was they put wooden beams, cedar of Lebanon, into the brick walls inside, some going horizontal, some going at right angles. So if you started to dig in, you'd hit a beam pretty fast, and you wouldn't know which way all the beams ran because they run different ways. So this is a really fortified place. Not only are the walls impressive, but the way the thing is laid out. If you were coming from Nubia by the land route, you got cataracts, the road goes right through the middle of the fort. You can't go around it. You can't go in the water. You've got to go marching through an Egyptian fort that's well manned. Now, what happens at this fort is Egypt takes its taxes. If you're a Nubian, say, coming to do some trade, and you've got leopard skins, you've got ivory, whatever it is, they are going to take their percentage right then and there before they allow you to continue. So this was both a nice military move and a terrific economic move. They really did well with these forts. So this is Sesostris I. Right? Now, he built his own pyramid, right? Another neat pyramid. So these people are really doing okay. He also erects two obelisks at Heliopolis. Now, Heliopolis is Greek for Sun City. It's a place of sun worship. And this in the Bible is called On, biblical On. One of the obelisks is still standing. You can see it today in Egypt if you go there. And you should all go there. He also builds a rather nice chapel at Karnak. And it's made out of alabaster. I mean, this is one of the really good works of art. It's beautiful, very refined. The hieroglyphs are just elegant. And you know what this shows? They're controlling the whole country. Because, first of all, the obelisk, right, the obelisk, granite comes from Aswan. The only place that this granite comes from is Aswan. So they're controlling Aswan. The alabaster comes further north. The alabaster quarries aren't in Aswan. That's further north. And if you look at the monuments of these people, there's all kinds of stones they're using. That means they're really controlling all of Egypt. Right? They're doing just fine. Now, remember, it's during his era, Sesostris I, that he writes this document called Advice of Amenemhat I to his son. He's using the press just like his father did. And he does one other thing that his father did. He takes his kid as co-regent. Again, establishing the order. Look, he saw his father was killed. And probably the only reason he became pharaoh was it was established that he was the co-regent. So he takes his son as co-regent. And the next pharaoh we get is Amenemhat II, named after dad, right? We're going to get an alternation of kings. It's going to be Amenemhat I, Sesostris I, Amenemhat II, Sesostris II. They can alternate for a while. Amenemhat II is another terrific pharaoh. Terrific. He sends an expedition to Punt. Now, Punt And I'm going to talk later in some detail about Punt. Punt, we think, is modern Eritrea, which is next to Ethiopia. Some people think it's Somalia, but I think it's Eritrea, but it's a big deal to send an expedition. You've got to go on the Red Sea to get there. And remember, the Egyptians weren't great sailors, so they didn't love this. What they did was, when they went down on the Red Sea, they hugged the coast. Every night they would anchor. You know, they weren't great navigators. But he sends an expedition to Punt. He controls all of, you know, all of Egypt also. And his big thing is foreign trade. Again, like Sneffel, remember? Sending out turquoise miners, that kind of thing. Does the same thing. If you look throughout the Middle East, you will see objects with Amenemhat II's name on it. In Lebanon, excavations have found jars with his name on it. And in his temples, excavations in Egypt have found things labeled from all over the Levant. That means they were trading with these people. It was an international time. These people were confident. They weren't worried about their borders. They're going everywhere. He builds a pyramid, right? So we got another pyramid. And then we're going to have another co-regency, right? They're keeping it up. Have that co-regency, and you'll have an established successor. Then we get Sesostris II, continues that family tradition of alternating names, right? And he increases the agriculture of Egypt. Now remember, the capital is in the Fayum, which is a nice, moist area, right? It's not desert by any means. And he reclaims land, expands irrigation ditches. So this is a family that is not only, you know, comfortable, they are aggressive. They are increasing the economy. They're pumping things into the economy. He has a pyramid also. And around his pyramid were burials for his princesses and some queens. And in one of these burials, the treasures of a princess named Sit-Hathor-Unet is her name, were found. Rather beautiful, really interesting excavation too, very hard. The tomb was discovered, robbed. It had been robbed in ancient times. But there was one section, and it seemed as if there were heavy rains at some point, or something overflowed, and mud flowed into the tomb. And one of the walls was kind of bricked up with mud, I mean like 1,000-year-old mud, 2,000-year-old mud. And the excavators at the beginning of this century removed the mud very carefully, and they found the gold jewelry of Princess Sit-Hathor-Unet. Beautiful gold jewelry, very fine. This is another place where the art historians can help you. You can look at a piece of jewelry and tell when it was made. Middle Kingdom jewelry is very fine, delicate, elegant, as compared with the kind of thing you're familiar with. You know Tutankhamun's jewels, those big gold bracelets and things, the rings? They're clunky. I mean, they're big, they're spectacular, they're heavy, but they're clunkers. Middle Kingdom jewelry is very fine. And along with this jewelry, they also found a jar, a magical jar, right? And it had an inscription on it that's just lovely. It's to give Sit-Hathor-Unet cold water for eternity. It was water that would be cool forever, so she could always have a drink and invigorate her. Really kind of nice. But Sesostris II is another great, great king. Then we get a little bit of a change. Sesostris III. He doesn't alternate names, right? It was Amenemhat I, Sesostris I, Amenemhat II, Sesostris II. Now we get Sesostris III. We get a couple of minor changes, but let me tell you about one change that I think is kind of neat that everybody will be able to see when you go to museums. The statues change. The art changes a little. Sesostris III, his statues, if you look from the neck down, it looks like an Egyptian statue, ordinary Egyptian statue, well-muscled, you know, idealized. But the face is tired. The corners of the mouth go down. The eyes droop. It's almost like he's saying, you know, I've seen it all. These are people who are, in a sense, saying, we're the shepherds of our country. We've done a lot, but we've suffered a lot. Amenemhat I is murdered. So it's interesting. The statues of the end of this dynasty all have this tired look. Quite interesting. He's a military leader, this guy. He's not afraid. He's 6'6", by the way. Big pharaoh. The average Egyptian, by the way, was something like 5'4 for a man, maybe 5'2 for a woman. Roughly maybe 5'5 is average. They were shorter than we are, right? But he was 6'6". Must have been pretty impressive in his time. He built temples everywhere. They're gone now, but they were there. We can see remains of them. And he has a pyramid. Built a pyramid. And you know where he puts his pyramid? At Dahshur. Why Dahshur? If you'll remember, Sneferu built his last two pyramids there. They're going back to the good old days. He's saying, I'm like Sneferu. Now we have his successor, who's Amenemhat III. Another long reign. Portraits are just like his father's. You can't tell the difference. If you look at the head of an Amenemhat III or something, it looks just the same. These tired faces. It's amazing. He has two pyramids. Now, why two pyramids? Well, remember, Snefru had a couple. Sasser had the southern burial. King of Upper and Lower Egypt. And he's saying, I can do it. One is at Dashur, back to Snefru, right? And another is at a place in the Fayum, Hawara. It's an interesting one. Tell you why. The entrance is not on the north. It's on the south. I think there's a sense, while these pharaohs are showing we're tired, we've had it, there's a sense of cynicism creeping in. They've seen tomb robbing. And he puts his entrance on the south so that tomb robbers won't be able to easily find it. It's an attempt at protecting what we've got. And let me tell you, it almost worked. I mean, it was robbed in antiquity, but one of the people it fooled was the excavator, Sir Flinders Petrie. Petrie came to the pyramid, saw it, it's a mud brick pyramid, came to it, looked at it, and he said, entrance on the north, no problem, because every other pyramid had its entrance on the north. He started excavating, and for nearly a decade, he was pulling away parts of this pyramid, looking for the entrance. Finally, he never found it on the south. What he did was, he went up to the top of the pyramid, started excavating straight down till he hit the burial chamber. And even then it wasn't easy. There were dead-end passageways intended to throw off the robbers. But it had been robbed. Probably the robbers were the guys, the construction workers who worked on it. But there are some interesting things. His sarcophagus was there. There was another sarcophagus, too. The burial chamber is kind of unusual, by the way. It's carved out of a big single block of quartzite. It's pretty big, about 22 feet by 8, something like that. It's big. And there are two sarcophagi inside, one for him and one for his daughter, the Princess Neferu Ptah. She probably died during his reign, and they put her there temporarily till she could have her own pyramid. But it's quite an impressive thing. Neferu Re's pyramid, by the way, was discovered. Interesting excavation, by the way. It had no entrance. What happened was, now she was dead, and then they started building the pyramid, so they cut a big pit in the ground, covered it over with limestone, and then built the pyramid on top of it. Right? And it's actually one of the few pyramids ever found, discovered, where there was a burial. But water had gotten up, and most of it had been destroyed. I mean, the body of Neferu Re was completely gone, dissolved in the water. There was about 4 feet of water in the tomb, and all you had was the beads from her jewelry was left. That's about all. When they finally pumped out the water in her sarcophagus, everything had settled to the bottom, about 3 inches worth. That's all. That was all they had of Neferu Ptah. But she had a pyramid. She was a king's daughter. Now, the end of the dynasty, we're not sure about much. Amenemhat IV is probably the last real king. Don't have much about him. We don't know where his pyramid is, if he had one. There's one temple for him in the Fayum we found, but it's terribly ruined. And the dynasty ends with a queen as king, or ruling at least, Sobekneferu. And that's a sign that there's trouble. Whenever you have a queen ruling, there's a problem. It's not a legitimate king. But all we know about her is she ruled for a few years, and then the dynasty ends. Now, after this dynasty, there's going to be another complete collapse of Egypt. But we know why this time there was a collapse. And we'll talk about that next time. See you then.